NATO armed forces are not ready for a modern drone war.
From what I see and hear, not a single NATO army is ready to resist the cascade of drones now.
And it's not just drone technology that most Western nations are behind on.
To deal with a world in which drones have become ubiquitous, I think is still in the to-do box for most Western militaries.
Today is Wednesday, March 5th, and this is The Issue from VOA. I'm Scott Walterman. In light of the fact that Europe may have to step into the role of being Ukraine's protector without the United States, an assessment that NATO armed forces are not ready for a modern drone war. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman reports that's the warning from the military commander in charge of Ukraine's unmanned systems.
Ukraine's armed forces have spent 3 years learning how to wage a modern drone war. And the country's top drone commander says it's the kind of combat the armies of NATO are not yet prepared to fight and need to be.
From what I see and hear, not a single NATO army is ready to resist the cascade of drones now.
Colonel Vadim Sukharevsky says Ukrainians have watched drone warfare advance in leaps and bounds. Over the course of 3 years since Russian forces invaded, Ukrainians have been forced to learn both how to use drones to counter Russia's overwhelming advantage in manpower and how to confront barrages of so-called suicide drones carrying explosive warheads launched at their cities and critical infrastructure. In an uneven fight, Ukrainian forces have used drones to pinpoint enemy positions and foil their ambushes.
If it had not been for drones, everything would have been a lot worse. Drones are the tool which gives us an asymmetrical response. The enemy is larger, stronger, and on the attack, and he doesn't value his soldiers' lives.
But Russia's use of drone warfare has shown just how difficult it can be to stop an enemy with an armada of cheap and deadly unmanned aircraft. Russia has deployed variants of the long-range Iranian-designed Shahed drone, which carries an explosive warhead. A Shahed can cost tens of thousands of dollars, but an interceptor missile to shoot one down can cost 10 times that.
It's just elementary mathematics. How much does a missile that shoots down a Shahed cost? How much does a Shahed cost? How much does it cost to deploy a ship, a plane, and an air defense system to fire at it? A Shahed drone is not a solution for all difficulties. It's not a dogma. There will be tens or hundreds of such drones, and it will develop because of this war.
Russian attacks on Ukraine, often numbering more than 100 drones, have become a regular occurrence. On Wednesday, residents of the city of Odessa were bombarded by a Russian drone attack. One woman who gave only her first name said more and more of the drones were getting through the air defenses.
In the beginning of the war, more drones were being shot down. It has been scary, but we felt like we were protected. Now they're falling on our heads like flies. They exploded around the house. Our house was completely blown out. One of the Shaheds hit the house directly.
Colonel Sukharevsky's warnings come as some NATO members in Europe ramp up defense spending to prepare for war, should the Ukraine conflict drag on or escalate. With U.S. support for Ukraine and Europe wavering, those efforts have intensified.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. Let's dig into this a bit more now. Joining us is Stephen Biddle, professor of international and public affairs at Columbia University. He's also an adjunct senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much for being able to talk to us about this.
Happy to be with you.
So NATO armed forces do not seem to be ready for a modern drone war, according to the military commander in charge of Ukraine's unmanned systems. And I suspect that probably at this point in time, Russia and Ukraine are the world experts on drone warfare?
Certainly at the tactical level, I think that's exactly right. Many Western militaries, including the United States, are transitioning out of an era in which they were focused on counterinsurgency into an era where they're focused on great power conflict and conventional warfare. And so a lot of what's going on in Western militaries at the moment is they're relearning the basics of conventional warfare against a great power opponent. The added duty of updating all that to deal with a world in which drones have become ubiquitous, I think, is still in the to-do box for most Western militaries.
I know Ukraine has built up a fairly substantial drone warfare industry over the last 3 years.
They have. They're producing indigenously the great majority of the drones they use, and they're churning them out by the hundreds of thousands. So the Ukrainian defense industry in general has expanded and improved its sophistication quite a bit since 2022, and that's especially true for drones.
I want to go back to something you said because it's sort of interesting. It's a roller coaster ride, sort of. Conventional warfare, a lot of the big militaries turn to a fighting terrorism stance. And then you have this conflict, which really has that traditional battlefield element that we haven't fought for a while.
Yeah, I think this kind of high-intensity, high-firepower, high-casualty warfare requires a lot of training to be proficient in. It's not the sort of thing where you can set it aside, focus on other things for 10 years, come back to it, and all of a sudden you can do it the way you did before. It's not like riding a bicycle that way. And I think it's been a long time since certainly the U.S. military, but many others in the West as well, have practiced this as intensively as you need in order to be able to synchronize all the dozens and dozens and dozens of different functions and activities and requirements that you have to do in order to fight this way and survive.
In terms of the Western powers' ability to not just wage the war once you're on the battlefield, but produce the material in sufficient numbers has also lapsed, has it not?
That's right. And since World War II, it's not clear that we were ever investing enough in munitions and war reserve stocks. This is something that the U.S. political system has disincentivized for a long time. But certainly the war in Ukraine is showing that the defense industrial base in the U.S. and in Europe both is not scaled appropriately for the expenditure levels that are characteristic of modern high firepower warfare.
There is also an economic element to moving towards drone warfare as well, because, you know, the drones are relatively inexpensive, even when you compare them with the missiles that are used to shoot them down, right?
Well, certainly, airplane by airplane, drones are vastly cheaper. In fact, what's distinctive about drones is primarily that they're a different point on the cost-performance relationship than we've seen in defense acquisition for a long time. So individually, they're very cheap. The way they get very cheap is by accepting much lower performance, much shorter range than traditional aircraft, much lower payload than traditional aircraft, and so on. The virtue of being cheap per copy is you can afford many copies. So when you look across the entirety of the drone fleet of a modern state, the Ukrainians or the Russians, it's absorbing a lot of expenditure. Individually, they're cheap, but then you buy them by their millions, and now you're spending quite a bit of money. But because they operate on a different point on the cost performance curve, low performance but very low cost, it then creates different incentives for those who want to defeat them and forces them to move to lower performance, lower cost air defense systems in order to counter them. The Patriot missile that has been the kind of marquee American air defense system of the last generation or two, is designed to destroy very expensive, very high-performance aircraft. It's overkill against a small quadcopter drone, and therefore it doesn't make sense to use them that way. What's happening right now in the defense industry across the West is defense firms are racing each other to develop low-performance but very low-cost air defense systems where you can shoot down a drone for nothing more than the cost of that drone. But there's a certain lag time in how quickly those kinds of new systems can be developed and fielded. And so right now, drones have a significant advantage over the defenses that are deployed against them. That's going to change over time as industry adapts and starts building cheaper air defense systems to shoot down cheaper airplanes.
Even within the drone world, there's different levels of cost, right? Like if you look at a Shahid, it can cost tens of thousands of dollars. But if you look at some of the things that Ukraine is producing, they're like thousands of dollars.
Yeah, I mean, you could choose any point, really, that you want on the cost performance curve. You could field, for military purposes, a $100 drone that will annoy you by buzzing around but has no weapon payload, doesn't explode, and won't destroy a tank. Or you can invest a little more and get a better drone, or a little more than that and get a still better drone. And you can go all the way up to supersonic drones that can reach Moscow, and the Ukrainians have deployed some of those too. So this is a spectrum of possibilities. The drone is not a single thing. What the term, to the extent that it has any meaning given the multiplicity of designs that are flying around in Ukraine right now, is simply that there's not a human pilot in the airplane. But beyond that distinction, there's just an enormous variety of different levels of cost, different levels of sophistication, different kinds of missions, different levels of performance. It's highly varied.
Then you also have the technology that blocks the communication between the operator and the drone.
Well, that's right. And characteristic of the Ukraine war has been a very high cycle rate of measure and countermeasure. That's been true for all sorts of military technologies, but certainly drones. So early war drones were relatively large, relatively expensive, and relatively vulnerable to orthodox air defenses, and so they didn't last long and were quickly replaced by cheaper drones that were flown by pilots who were sitting on the ground with a joystick. That required radio communication between the pilot on the ground with the joystick and the drone. That radio communication could be jammed. And so there was an intensive effort to deploy radio frequency jammers that could interfere with the control function of the drone and render the drone incapable. That's changing too. The Russians now deploy a large number of fiber optic guided drones in which the communications from the pilot on the ground with the joystick to the drone in the air are not by radio frequency transmissions that can be jammed, but are messages being sent along a fiber optic cable that's paid out behind the drone as it flies and connects them to the ground in a way that's harder to jam. Eventually, drones will become autonomous, where they're making their own decisions about where targets are and how to navigate to them. That will likewise be more difficult to jam, but will free drones of the need for this umbilical cord, this fiber optic cable that connects them to the ground. There's been a rapid pace of new development in the drone war in Ukraine.
There's always been a technological race when it comes to the development of military technology. You know, think about World War I and the deployment of tanks, and World War II and the real use of air power, which ameliorated the traditional, methods of attack. And in comparison to what we have seen historically, how rapid now is the development of this new technology?
Well, I mean, I, Intuitively, it of course seems very rapid, and in meaningful military terms, there's a quick turnaround between measure and countermeasure in Ukraine. But as you're suggesting, the measure countermeasure race is ubiquitous in warfare, and in many past cases, countermeasures have appeared quite quickly. The tank was introduced in the middle of the Great Offensive on the Somme in 1916 in World War I. In less than 12 months, the Germans were already fielding purpose-built anti-tank weapons that were inflicting loss rates north of 90% in tank attacks in 1917 and 18. So these cycles can move quickly. And given that, I think the key message for policymakers now is beware of the fallacy of the last move. When drones first became ubiquitous in Ukraine, there was a wave of arguments that they were revolutionizing warfare and would dominate the battlefield in the future. The countermeasures to drone warfare are catching up, and the countermeasures are already being fielded. We're already seeing counter-drone drones, for example. And I think it's likely that we're going to see something like a recapitulation of the history of air warfare in an unpiloted drone domain, in which the same kinds of air warfare dynamics we've seen in the past will unfold, but without pilots in the cockpits, at lower levels of cost, and with larger numbers of platforms as a result. That doesn't necessarily mean that the drones will be the single decisive weapon in warfare moving forward or not. The cycle moves fast, and neither the drone nor anti-drone weapons are likely to have permanent advantages.
So it's just like part of the normal cycle of warfare technology.
I think it is. Now, that's not to say that nothing ever changes and everything is always the same, right? So as technology moves forward, the nature of these measure-countermeasure races changes over time. The reason you couldn't get very, very low-cost, very low-performance airplanes in 1918 was because the electric motors that are required to power the smallest of the drones in use in Ukraine right now hadn't been invented yet. So, I mean, the progressive change in technological knowledge over time changes the parameters and the nature of the measure-countermeasure race, but it's very unlikely ever to create a permanent end to the measure-countermeasure race. It's very unlikely that the drone will drive all other weapon types from the battlefield and dominate, or that the drone will become irrelevant and will be swept from the skies by anti-drone technologies. Something like a combined arms battlefield in which many types of weapons are in use will probably persist for a long time. Something like, again, a recapitulation of the multiplication of air missions, including anti-air missions, that we saw at higher performance, higher cost points on the cost performance curve in the past are likely to occur. The fallacy of the last move is a bad idea, and we should steer clear of it.
I guess the bottom line is increased military research and spending is what you need if this is the course of action you're pursuing.
Yeah. Now, whether that means the defense budget needs to be larger or not is, of course, a different question. The Hegseth Defense Department at least claims that it's not necessarily going to reduce the defense budget, but it's definitely going to move money around. So certainly there's going to be a growth market for drones and air defenses that fight drones in the future. Whether that leads to increased expenditure on defense per se or not is a function of how militaries allocate their spending. Now, clearly, the European countries are going to be increasing their defense budgets ceilings quite a bit to compensate for the fact that they've underinvested for so long, and they're now looking at a world in which they might have to defend themselves without the United States. But whether or not the drone, counter-drone, measure-countermeasure race requires an expansion in defense spending or simply a reallocation of defense spending is a function of all sorts of larger geopolitical considerations than just measures and countermeasures for drones.
Hmm. Thank you so much for the info. It's really interesting.
Happy to talk with you.
Stephen Biddle, professor of international and public affairs at Columbia University and an adjunct senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. You've been listening to The Issue from the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA in Washington and in all of our bureaus across the globe, thank you so much for joining us. For news 24/7, check out our website at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.